The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening, everybody. Before we begin our presentation tonight, I wanted to welcome everyone to the second session of, actually it's our second series in the Five Towns, the parenting program. For those who were not here last time, and those who are not so familiar with Priority One, amongst many educational programs, we started several years ago a parenting and teacher training seminar program. I mean, we go into different communities throughout the country. We've been up to approximately, we've done 15 communities up to date, and we have many more scheduled. But we go into different communities and we arrange all the local schools of that particular community, as well as shuls, and we conduct these parenting and teacher training seminars, two separate tracks, one for parents and one for teachers, addressing different but pretty much in the same ballpark, the same issues, just a different angle for teacher and student relationship and a parent and child relationship. The basic goal for these seminars it's basically twofold. One is addressing the awareness and the facts of what issues and challenges our youth are faced with on a daily basis today's day and age, which many even experienced mechanchim and experienced parents, good parents and good mechanchim, they're just not aware and not familiar with the facts. So we educate in terms of the facts of what's out there, and then we have our speakers, psychologists and rabbanim, very experienced rabbanim and psychologists in the field, and they address how to go about these issues and how to solve and approach it in a positive manner, which makes the whole difference of making or breaking a child. We've been privileged tonight, I feel a little funny giving an introduction to someone so internationally renowned as a top psychologist, lecturer, and author, as well as a professor in the Azrieli graduate program in Yeshiva University, Dr. David Pelkovitz. Just before I forget, we have another session coming up a week from tonight. Rabbi Shaya Cohen is going to be speaking. The topic is protecting your child's Yiddishkeit, which is going to address how to intervene before it's too late and how to preempt and prevent issues that may arise if you're not well equipped to addressing these particular issues. Again, the name speaks a lot more than any introduction that I could give. I'd like to introduce Dr. David Pelkovitz. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Probably an L and then questions.
Hi, everybody. I was asked, the topic's a nice topic. It's bringing joy and happiness to parenting, which is I've been asked to speak about either of those topics separately, but I don't know that I've ever been asked to speak about them as a specific topic together, and I think it's actually a great springboard for talking about all kinds of interesting issues that we could bring home to our children. I'm going to talk about four components of this. The first part is going to be the geometry of happiness. I'm going to speak a little bit about the geometry of happiness, weaving in some Jewish thoughts, psychological thoughts, and then I'm going to talk about a couple of other topics. What I mean by the geometry of topics, I'm going to start with talking about the line and then the circle. And I haven't lost my mind, you'll see. There's hopefully some logic to that. I'll start with the line. The line is basically the research on how does the secular view of happiness differ from the Jewish view of happiness? The secular view of happiness is basically the word happy comes from the root word of H-A-P. You ever think about what are some of the words that have H-A-P at the beginning? Haphazard, hapless, happenstance. The tzad hashava there, the commonality is by chance, but mikre. Happiness is somehow, what's woven into the word is the idea that if you're lucky enough in life to come up with the magic of happiness, the magic or the chance of winning the lottery or having a lot of money or somehow being lucky enough to somehow happen upon the ingredients of happiness, that's going to be your ticket. Contrast that to the Hebrew word simcha, which is a whole different concept. It's actually in some ways the opposite. Simcha, which some say is connected to the words shum moach, it's where your head is at. If your head is at a place of meaning, if your head is at a place of connection, that's where happiness comes from in the Jewish view. So the Jewish view of happiness, I'm often amazed at back when I was working at North Shore Hospital for many years, I'd come back to work Isru Chag of Rosh Hashanah, and my colleagues would say to me, "So you have a hangover?" And it would take a while till I realized what they meant. To them, it's the new year. And then, when they come back from the day after New Year's Eve, the day after New Year's, they have hangovers. And that's their idea of what happiness. And compare that to the Simcha Shel Mitzvah of Yontif. Beautiful Rambam that talks about Simchas Yontif. And he talks about how he contrasts the different ways you could celebrate Yontif. He says, if you celebrate Yontif by just having your family and sitting down and eating and drinking with your immediate family, he says, Ein zu simchas mitzvah, el simchas kreisa. That's the simcha, not of mitzvah. It's the happiness of your stomach. True happiness, he goes on to say on Yontif, the true simchas Yontif is when you sit down at the table and you share your food, and you share your wine, and you share your company with umlalim and mare nefesh, to use part of his lashon, that's Simcha Shel Mitzvah. You can't celebrate Yontif without connecting through chesed and without connecting to the community. It's not enough to just have the individual celebration. It has to be a celebration that includes connectedness. So let me bring this to parenting a little bit. What am I talking about with the straight line? The straight line is basically what Chazal tell us about that component of happiness. It tells us that in order to understand l'yishrei lev simcha, the straight of heart, the simcha that comes with being a yishrei lev, we have to be connected to our goals. We have to be connected to meaning. It's all about connection to the enduring, connection to find our own individual uniqueness combined with connection to Hashem. We all know the famous Mamar Chazal, Ein ba'olam simcha kataras hesvekos. So what does that mean? Think about it. It's a brilliant, psychologically brilliant insight. It says there is no greater joy in life than the resolution of doubt. There's nothing quite as disconcerting or sad-making, as not being connected to meaning. In fact, we know the highest rates of depression are what you have in children who are first-generation Americans, because they don't feel like they fully belong to their parents' culture and country, and they don't feel like they belong fully to the current peer group here in America. As a matter of fact, I once worked with a child psychiatry fellow at North Shore Hospital who told me that she wanted to do a research project when she saw that the first 10 consecutive admissions she did at the hospital for suicide attempts of adolescents in their adolescent unit were all first-generation Americans. And it hit her that this is an incredible risk factor, that lack of connection. So you have, on the one hand, the incredible need to belong, the incredible need to connect, the incredible need to have simcha that comes from the simcha of connection, and we have to offset that against the non-Jewish view of happiness, which is happiness by being lucky enough to be wealthy, which of course is not at all connected to happiness, or by just happening to be lucky. Interestingly, the opposite of the straight line is a crooked line. the word Amalek, which stands for happenstance, is actually an anagram for the word Mu'ukal, which means crooked. And our rabbis tell us that Amalek is actually in gematria suffek or doubt. So we have the juxtaposition of connection to the certain, connection to truth. The Chazon Ish said it best. The Chazon Ish said, for he who knows the light of truth, there is no sadness in the world. Okay? Now, I know I'm meandering. I'm going to get there. I'm going to get to the straight line. By the way, in Divrei, in Kabbalah, Amalek is often compared to Zvuv, a fly that goes around randomly. What does this have to do with parenting? I'll tell you what it has to do with parenting. It turns out that there's all kinds of recent research that shows that one of the pathways to happiness for children is being able to connect to their uniqueness by helping them reach goals. When you have people, let's think about it for adults for a second. When you think about it for adults, this actually really brings it out. There's a fascinating new field called positive psychology. It's a focus on, not on pathology, but a focus on the positive in psychology. In that field, one of the researchers in the area does a very simple test. They have people sit down and they have them write, where do you want to be in 10 years? Sit down, write your goals. What are your goals? It's called the best possible self exercise. Listen to this exercise. In the best possible self exercise, you're asked to spend 20 minutes a day on 4 consecutive days writing a description of your best possible future self. You visualize where is it that you want to go. You try to imagine what your life would be like if all of your dreams were realized. In essence, what it's about is getting in touch with the reality of realizing your most cherished long-term dreams. Now, a weird thing happens when you do it. It has nothing to do with realizing the goals. Just by sitting down and connecting to the essence of where your heart and neshama want you to go, all of a sudden your happiness level goes up, and in the longitudinal research, it turns out you're more likely to realize those goals when you articulate them in that way. It's said best in Mishle. Pasuk in Mishle says, Be'ein chazon yifara am. Without that vision thing, we wither away. You need vision. The Pizesna Rebbe, who was the Rav of the Warsaw Ghetto during those horrible years of the extermination of the ghetto by the Nazis, Yimach Shemam, he only had one sefer published in his lifetime. The rest was found out after his murder by the Nazis. So the sefer is a well-known sefer called Choves HaTalmidim, and it's a brilliant, brilliant work on how to raise an educated Jewish child. You know what he used to do with his Talmidim? He used to have an exercise, or actually it was a requirement if you were a Talmud of the Piazesna, where you'd have to sit down and you would have to project yourself 6 months into the future to imagine what are your goals in the next 6 months. When you do that, when children do that, when families do that, when they focus on what matters to them, all kinds of interesting things start to happen. Now, how do you connect this to parenting? Many of you are parents of young children. How do you connect this to your day-to-day life? My belief is that we have to think about this as we raise and direct our children, because one of the key ingredients of happiness is the ability to connect our children to where their true bracha lies, to where their true potential lies. To quote Rav Yerucham Levavitz, if you try to give a bracha or push a child in a direction that does not match their potential, it's like pouring water on a plot of land where there's no seed underneath it. In order for there to be a connection between our wishes and dreams for our children and their realizing their potential, we have to fan the flames of their uniqueness. We have to fan the flames that will allow them to reach those goals. It's a very important issue. What does the research say about goal setting? The research says that the goals that are most likely to result in happiness are goals that are intrinsic, meaning that kids are doing them lishma. They're doing it not because of fear of punishment or wanting a reward. They're doing it because their inner spark tells them, this is where I am, this is who I am, this is what I want to be. Those are the goals that lead to simcha. Also, goals that are authentic, not coming from expectations of family or society, but coming from inside. Where's your neshama leading to realize your tafkid and to realize your uniqueness? And also, goals that are conceptualized in a way that a child is challenged and not threatened. So there's like a match between their abilities and their potential and their skills. So that we're constantly challenging them to just go a little bit beyond where they are as an engine of growth. But certainly not challenging them to become something that their temperament doesn't allow. I had an interesting story. I don't even know how appropriate it is to tell. But I was just thinking about this story as I was thinking about what to talk about tonight. And it was a story that took place in California a few years ago, where I was talking about the importance of letting your child realize their own dreams and not having them play out your fantasies instead, as all too often happens. So there was a man who was waiting for me. I was about to catch the red eye back to New York. And I was giving this talk in the Beverly Hills area. And there was a firm guy there waiting for me. And he tells me the following story. He says, you know something? He says, you just got me in touch with how heroic my parents are. So I asked him, tell me a little bit about yourself. He said, look, he said, I grew up the child of two Holocaust survivors. And my parents' dream was that Hitler never allowed them to go to college. Hitler never allowed them to have much of an education. And they always had a dream for me that they knew I was a good student. And to them, their dream was that I become a doctor. And he said, Baruch Hashem, I was a good student. I was a really good student. And I made it actually into Harvard Medical School. Okay, so a guy growing up in Beverly Hills, could you imagine how incredibly proud his parents were? He'd gone to yeshiva. His parents, it was their ultimate dream come true. It's their victory over Hitler. And this summer, just before he was supposed to start medical school, he starts to get in touch with the fact that it's not really what he wants, that it was their dream, not his dream. As he started to look deeply into who he was, he realized, you know what, this isn't me. This just isn't me. I'll be miserable. You can't live your life in order to realize your parents' dreams. You have to find your own spark and then maybe make your parents proud based on your finding your own uniqueness and finding your own tafkid and lighting up your own fire. So he tells his mother and father, he calls them into a room sometimes that July, and he says to them, you know, look, I just decided I really can't be happy being a doctor. So they say, what do you want to do? Get ready. I don't know what I would have done if it was one of my kids. He says, I want to go into the entertainment industry. So you could just imagine the entertainment industry. So they figure, look, he's growing up in Beverly Hills. He's growing up surrounded by the glitter and glamour of that empty world. And his dream is to go into an industry where the odds of success are like one in a million. And he said, now that I think about it, I realize that it must have taken every ounce of my mother's and father's energy not to let out a blood-curdling scream. Could you imagine? He said they swallowed it, and I don't even think they had to consult with each other. They said, look, you have to follow your heart. Do what makes you happy. This is what he said. Hard to imagine. I don't know many parents who could do it. Then he says to me, I know you're about to catch the red eye. You're about to go on the plane back to New York, back to JFK. He said, can you do me a favor? He said, buy the New York Times. The Sunday Times has the top 10 list of every industry. And then he says, you'll see, look up the top 10 grossing films of this week in the United States. He said, all three are mine. All three are mine. Okay? Now, really amazing. It turns out he was a famous guy. I found out later. People said, don't you know who you were talking to? Okay. But I don't. I know nothing about that world, but evidently, probably some of you will recognize who he is just from what I'm saying. And by the way, he's known to be totally from guy and known to be a tremendous. I mean, it doesn't mean that he left who he was. It just means that he found himself. He needed to realize who he was in his own voice, Okay, I don't know how appropriate a story, but it's an interesting story. Okay, so take-home message number one is the message of happiness versus simcha, of happiness being that kind of random, kind of disconnected happiness epitomized by thinking real success in life is money. What is it? There was that ad that Lexus used to have. Whoever said money can't buy happiness isn't spending it right. It has a big picture of a Lexus, and that's the tagline, okay? And we all know what the research is about the connection between money and happiness. Once your basic needs are met, there's really no connection at all. And the highest rate of depression in America is in affluent adolescents. That's a talk in itself. Actually, I gave in this room a few years ago on that money-children connection. Very interesting topic. So goal setting is important. Figuring out where you're going, nurturing the simcha that comes with finding who you really are in the context of finding truth. And I'll talk about the connection between this and spirituality and religion a little bit later. Number two is, I said I was going to talk a little bit about the geometry of happiness. So let me talk now about the circle. Talk a little bit about the circle. Anybody know the connection between a circle and happiness? The connection between a circle and happiness is obvious. It's the machal. The Radak says, Hafachta misbedi l'machali. We say it every morning in davening and mizmar shir. We say that David HaMelech is asking for mechila from Hashem, and when he hears that he's being given mechila, he is elated. And the Radak talks about the connection between the word mechila, machal, and happiness. And in fact, when you think about it, how is the circle different than the line? The line is connection to the straight path of who we really are. The line is connection to meaning. The circle is, think about in Jewish thinking, on Hoshana Rabbah, we would circle around the Mizbeach, you circle around the Bema. Simchas Torah, the Torah is all circle around the source of meaning. Lasid Lavo, the Gemara tells us that tzaddikim will sit in a machal around Hashem and experience true eternal happiness. And we all know that at a wedding, it's the bride, the kala, circling the chasan, and then we, as people trying to be mesameach the chasan and kala, circling the chasan, circling the kala as we dance. You ever get that feeling that you're out of the circle? You ever go to a dance at a wedding and the kala is not including you in the dance, the chasan's not including you in the dance? It sort of feels a little odd. You feel like you're out of the circle. You feel you're out of the circle. Being part of a circle is being connected to community. It's a symbol in Divrei Chazal for connection and happiness through connection. So happiness comes in two ways. It comes by developing our inner self, and parents who raise children to connect to their uniqueness. And it comes from helping connect our children to the kehila around meaning. Now, the question becomes, what are some of the ways that we do this? How do we bring that happiness to our children? And I'll talk just for a little bit about the research on the need to figure out a way to connect our children to the kehila through chesed. I just want to talk about it because it's a key component of happiness. Key component of happiness is getting our children beyond themselves. Sure, we have to nurture their uniqueness. And I know the questions later on are going to ask me. I already know what the questions are going to be. And the questions are going to be very well-placed questions, which are how in a cookie-cutter world of the yeshiva, where there are very cookie-cutter demands of our children, how do we fan the flame of their uniqueness? And we'll talk about it. I don't have any easy answers. We could at least frame the questions. But in terms of the circle, there in some ways it's easier. The simcha for our children that comes from connection to the circle that comes from the machal, comes from that component of happiness. It comes from basically requiring our children to pitch in, requiring our children to do chesed without overburdening them. And study after study shows us this connection. I'll just throw out one adult study, and then I'll get more specific about kids. The one adult study that I came across not too long ago was they take a bunch of people with multiple sclerosis, and they divide them into two. These are people with equal levels of severity of multiple sclerosis. So one group is randomly assigned to the other. So let's say you take one individual with MS, and you take her and you say, your job is to take care of this other woman with MS. Turns out, she is just as sick. The person who's assigned to help, one person is the no-sane, another person is the makabel. So the no-sane is said, you help this woman out. You help her out. Help her out. Take her shopping, take her to the doctor, call her up every day to see how she's feeling. And the other person is the makabel, just the recipient of that stucca. Do you know that would, as you follow this, 2 months later, 6 months later, a year later, the one who's the no-sane, the one who's going outside of herself to help the other person, not only does she show significantly higher level of happiness, but she also shows a significant remission in her MS symptoms relative to her friend. Not chas v'shalom, I'm not saying that it's a psychological illness. I'm saying that there's something about going beyond yourself that could actually help, perhaps, with the psychoneuroimmunologic parts of certain kinds of illnesses. It's an amazing thing. The word natan, as some of you have heard me say before, is a palindrome. The word natan is a palindrome. What's a palindrome? A palindrome is a word that's the same forwards as backwards. My name is a palindrome, David, right? Abba is the palindrome. Natan, to give, is the palindrome. Because when you give, you get back even more. Or you get back at least as much. So my modest recommendation on this component of simcha, my modest recommendation is that figure out a way to get your children, even young children, to give. It could be starting by having them do simple chores. It could be by having them help. You know, it's very hard sometimes when you, Baruch Hashem, we live in probably the most affluent community in the history of the Jewish people. We're talking about the American community in general. You know, when you think about the incredible gifts that we're given in terms of the material comfort that many of us are blessed with. And it becomes easy to not think about, to not take a step back and think about our goals when it comes to realizing the goals for our children to get past themselves. You know, you have to require them to make the bed, even if the housekeeper will do it for them, or to clean off the table after a meal and help maybe even with the dishes, even if it only means putting it in the dishwasher because you no longer have to wash and dry dishes. It's something to think about. The research shows it really makes a difference. The research shows that when you have kids who go through stressful times in life, one of the three key predictors of resilience is the ability to require children to go beyond themselves to give to others and to do chesed for others and to be part of helping out the family by doing chores and other kinds of things. I'm going to tell you a story with apologies to the few people who may have heard this story, but it's such a great story, it makes me feel great. It's the story of the 9-year-old girl and blind woman. I know that at least a few of you, how many of you have heard that story? Okay, actually, one or two. So with apologies, it's Chazar. It makes me feel good to tell it. So isn't it a great story? It's a good story. So I'll tell you this story, and with this I'll wrap up the circle part of the program, okay? So of simcha, of true simcha, and bringing simcha into our children's lives. Because it really is. It's about that. It's about a beautiful medrash my father just pointed out to me. A medrash on Shir HaShirim that talks about a very interesting line in the Medrash. At first blush, doesn't make sense till you look at it through the prism of what we're talking about. The Medrash talks about the Umos Ha'olam come to Bnei Yisrael. They come to they come to us and they say, "Look, we recognize that you're a unique people. We recognize that. We recognize that you're special. Your God," they say, has not done very much for you. Look at you. You're persecuted. You're in Golos. You've had a tough time. Come to our side. And then it says, if you come to our side, we'll make you generals. We'll make you captains. We'll make you leaders. It'll be good for you here. So listen to the answer that the Jews give in the Medrash. It's a very puzzling answer. Among the reasons they say why they won't do it is they say, give up our position of being in the circle around the Mishkan in the Midbar, Ishal Machneh of Ishal Diglo, give up the circle. So my father showed me a beautiful thought, I forget, a sefer he has from a Rav in Denver from the 1930s. So it's an unbelievable insight. He says, what does this mean? It means, what's the circle about? Give up the circle of our uniqueness. And he points out that what happens when you dance in a circle? You could dance all night, and you get tremendous achdus from dancing. The new neurobiologic research is showing that when you dance rhythmically, repetitively in a circle together holding hands, feelings of elation come over you, actually fed by certain neurobiologic changes in our brain. But you know what happens, he points out, when you dance in that circle, as the Jews in the Medrash tell us, you end up in exactly the same place. Because you're not traveling in space, you're traveling in time. And you're traveling in time back to the Mesorah and the connection and the meaning, that's the essence of Simcha that I've been talking about, of the Shamoach, the essence of that. So here's the story. Here's the story on the second ingredient. A little girl, 9 years old, very shy girl. Her mother, who's a friend of mine, Chassidish woman, tells me this incredible story. Story is, it's a community, Chassidish community in a poor neighborhood. And everybody does chesed. It's in some ways easier to require chesed of kids and of families in a poor neighborhood. You have to pitch in together to take care of each other. So they hear that at 2 apartments down, a blind woman in her 60s, early 60s, moves into the community. And they find out she's totally alone. She was the Baal Shuva, her parents aren't alive, she never married, she's been blind from birth, and she's totally, totally alone in the world. So my friend tells me, look, in our community, you know, it's Olam Chesed Iban, everybody gets assigned a different job, and I turn to my shy 9-year-old, and I tell her, I don't ask her, your job, 2 nights a week, you go over to that home and you read to her. After school, you go straight to her house and you read to her. Girl doesn't ask any questions. That's what you have to do. Required helpfulness. Real source of simcha. And she does it. And she develops a kesher with the woman. And one night, she finishes reading to the woman. And the woman sighs and she says, 2 more years. In 2 more years, I'll be able to see. So the little girl says, what do you mean you can't see? You're blind. She says, you know something? A doctor gave me an exam a while ago, and he told me I don't have to be blind anymore. He told me they have now laser surgery that could cure my blindness. They couldn't do it when I was a little girl, but now they could cure it, but I don't have that kind of money. She says, but in 2 years, I'm going to get Social Security. And in 2 years, when I start collecting Social Security, I'll be able to save up enough money to be able to afford the surgery eventually. Little girl doesn't ask any questions. She doesn't tell her mother. She doesn't tell anybody. The next day, she goes running to school. She overcomes her shyness, and she goes from classroom to classroom in her yeshiva. And she mumbles. She says, there's a woman in the building near me. She's blind. We need to raise money for her to not be blind anymore. She goes from class to class to class. The end of the day, she has an envelope, and she goes running home, running to this woman's house. And she says, Mrs. Schwartz, I have the money. I have the money for the operation. You'll be able to see. Let's go. And she takes out 83 crumpled single dollar bills. What does the 9-year-old girl know? Okay? Mrs. Schwartz doesn't have time to ask any questions. They take her cane. There's a frum ophthalmologist around the corner in this neighborhood. And the little girl drags poor Mrs. Schwartz to the ophthalmologist's office. There's no appointment. They sit down and they wait. The ophthalmologist comes out after all his patients are finished, and he sees the strange sight of a 9-year-old girl and this blind old woman with a cane. He calls them in. He examines Mrs. Schwartz, and he says to her, "You're right. There's no reason for you to be like this. No reason whatsoever. I'm gonna do the surgery." Checks her into the local hospital, does the surgery. She could see. After she has enough rehab to get around on her own, what's the first thing you would do? You have to go to be Makar Tov. You have to go to thank this little girl and her mother. So she goes back to her block. She asks the little girl, the people, "Where does this little girl live?" And she goes to the mother, who still knew nothing about it. She knew nothing. And she tells her the story. So the mother hears the story, and she's blown away, first of all, with tremendous pride in her daughter. But she also realizes that she has quite a debt to pay. So she goes around the corner, and she waits patiently to see the doctor. And she goes to the doctor, and she says, "I'm that little girl's mother, and I realize that we have a tremendous debt to you. I know it doesn't cost $83 to do this kind of surgery, and the hospital bill alone, maybe that'll pay for the TV in the room in the hospital. It's not going to pay for much more." And she says, "Look, I don't have money. I don't have much money," she says, "but put me on a payment plan, and I'll also raise some money from the community, and little by little, I will make good on the debt that our family incurred by your having to do this." The doctor laughs. He says, "Come on." He says, "How often does somebody have the opportunity to restore sight to a blind woman?" But he says to her, "But do me a favor." He says, "Can I ask you one thing?" He reaches into his pocket, and he takes out the tattered envelope and shows her the 83 singles. And he said, "Can I keep this? I just want to keep this." He says, "You know something?" He said, "Since your daughter came into my office, I've been carrying this around wherever I go. And whenever I have a tough day, I just reach into my pocket, I feel the envelope, and restores my faith in humanity. Natan is a palindrome. It's so many levels in this story. Natan is a palindrome, same forwards, same backwards, but the power of the circle, the power of requiring our children to join the circle. This never would have happened with this little girl if the mother didn't, in a matter-of-fact way, say, "This is your job. You're a member of the community. You're a member of our kahil. You're a member of the machal. Surround it. Surround the meaning. Come, do it." And that's a key to simcha. That's the real simcha. That's the simcha shel mitzvah that the Rambam talks about. It's the simcha of connection to truth that the Chazon Ish talks about. It's the true simcha that's the opposite of the simcha's kreso, of the hap, of happenstance and happiness. So that's number two. So number one is uniqueness. Number one is the straight line. The number one is Ein Bolam Simcha Chatoras HaSveikos, connecting our children to the meaning of the straight line through realizing their uniqueness with the three ingredients that we talked about. And number two is the other part of the geometry, which is the circle of chesed, the circle of connection, the circle of community. And with a specific example of acquired helpfulness. Number three, I want to talk a little bit about this. It's just a cool thing that I came up with recently and I've been thinking about a lot. And it's the third ingredient. And then I guess I have time. You gave me plenty of time. Okay, I have time to really develop the 4 points I wanted, so thank you for that. Number three is a weird experience I had wearing my researcher's hat. I did a study together with some colleagues in six yeshiva high schools in the New York metropolitan area, and we tried to look at hundreds of from kids. We wanted to look at what is it that predicts high levels of emuna, high levels of bein adam l'makom, bein adam l'chavera. What is it that predicts religious action and religious beliefs? So I, for many years of my life, when I was director of psychology at North Shore, I wore a research hat as part of my job. And I figure I have a new job now where I have a chance to give back to the firm community. So they're wonderful in giving me whatever I asked for, they let me do. So I said I want to do this study, so I'm doing this study. And I throw a lot of variables. We have these kids. We ask them a lot of questions. We ask them about, including some schools right here, within a few blocks of here, not allowed to say what schools, but wonderful yeshiva high schools. So we throw into the following variables into the mix. Say, what is it that predicts our dreams of our children growing up to be banim tovim u'mehuganim? What is it that predicts it? So we throw into the equation is things like self-concept, psychological functioning. How well do the kids get along with you? How well do the kids get along with their rebbeim, with the mechanechet? How long do they get along with friends? We looked at, at least 20-something variables to see what is it that predicts, what doesn't predict. And after some very hard work, we actually finished the second part of the study just a couple of weeks ago. We gave this to about 500 kids in Eretz Yisrael. We're following them up to see what happens during the course of the year of study in Eretz Yisrael, and we're going to have answers to that hopefully very soon. And then we're going to follow it down the road to see what to just understand this a little bit better. If you have to picture, I'm in the office with my research colleagues and with a statistician, and you finally throw everything into the computer and you push a button. It's a very exciting moment. It's the fruition of a year's work. Not a year's, but a year's project. And the thing that comes out, I look at it, I think, oh, this is a disaster. It makes no sense whatsoever. I forgot I even put it into the study. What comes out, number one? The level of positivity, the level of optimism that parents and school convey to the child about Avodas Hashem. I look at it, and it's a measure we have. It's, you know, if anybody's curious, I doubt you will be, but it's a measure that sort of taps this in a reliable and valid way. So I look at it, I say, look, no, this is a mistake. Let's run it again. Same thing. By far the most predictive. Number one, above parent-child relationships, above the relationship with the Rebbe, you name it, it's number one. So I say, wow, I better look at this seriously. What is it? And what it's about is this measuring. Are they connecting to Hashem? Are they being raised to connect to Hashem through the Ahava dimension or the Yira dimension? Is their religion, is the religion and the view of Yadus being conveyed to them? The Yadus of Ayat Shveretz Zayin Yid that Rav Moshe would talk about, that was responsible for many lost Jewish souls? Or is it the positive? Is it a connection to the beauty and love of Shabbos? Or love of Yiddishkeit. I had this interesting conversation with somebody. It might have been tied to Priority One Shabbaton once. They tell me that there's a kid who had been very much at risk, and he goes to a mainstream camp for this summer, but a camp that does a lot of talking about Hashkafa. It was an NCSY-type camp. The parents... He was already quite rebellious. The parents in desperation, but he was going to a Black Hat yeshiva. The parents in desperation sent him to this camp, who doesn't know the kind of problems the kid has, and he comes back and he's transformed. They didn't expect that to happen. They were sure he'd be kicked out. They didn't even tell the camp about all the problems he has. He comes back, he's transformed. He's back to being a firm kid. So the parents are totally puzzled, and they ask him, what happened? He said, look, he said, until I went to this place, my understanding of Hashem was the Hashem of the nose. Okay? No, don't do this. You're not allowed to do this on Shabbos. You're not allowed to say this. You're not allowed to think that. He says, but I didn't know who the Abishta is. Who is Hashem? He said, I spent the last 2 months. They sat with me and they explained to me. Basic Hashkafa. And I love it. He connected through the Ahava dimension. It's the power of optimism, the power of a focus and connection. If you're sitting down and learning with your child, if your connection with your child over anything Jewish is through the negative and through fighting, it's not going to be good. You figure out how to connect through love. Now, I know reality, we're going to get questions, you're going to hold me to reality, it's not so easy. I don't like reality at all. But theoretically, this is what we have to hope for. I'll tell you a study that's in Yonah Dioma, and then I'll move on to the final dimension. The study is the study of told to me by Rabbi Dr. Sachs, Sir Sachs, the chief rabbi of the UK. So I was asked to go there for a few days. They have a rabbinic conference every couple of years with the rabbis of the big shuls in that part of the world, and they asked me to be the scholar for those 2 days. And Rabbi Sachs sat in the front row for every talk I gave, took notes, and then gave me a critique afterwards. It was wonderful. It was actually an incredible learning experience. And he told me, he gave me hadracha in certain areas, you know, to add his insights to what he heard. He's a brilliant, brilliant man. So I must have talked something about what we're talking about tonight. And he had one piece of insight. You know, he's a very respected political consultant in the UK. He's friendly with the Queen, friendly with the Prime Minister. And he has a good, keen political sense. So he told me there was somebody running for office, a high office in England. He wouldn't tell me who. But he was running on a very anti-Semitic platform. Anti-Jewish, anti-Israel, because that's the way to curry favor with the Arab vote. So the guy was scaring him. So he calls him up and he says, listen, can I come by? I want to talk to you. So the candidate says, Rabbi, with all due respect, there isn't anything you could say that'll change my mind. You're not going to change my mind on Israel. You're just not going to change my mind on the political situation. I'm not going to waste my time. I'm a busy man. So Rabbi Sachs said, look, I'll make you a deal. I'll come to just give you political advice, free political advice. I will not say the word Jewish or Israel in my conversation with you. If I do, just kick me out of the office. So the guy was intrigued. He says, good, I'll give you 5 minutes. So Rabbi Sachs came and he told him the following study. This is all he said and he left. The study was a study done by Martin Seligman, famous psychologist, the founder of positive psychology at University of Pennsylvania. And the study was a brilliant study. What he did was is he took his graduate students and he gave them the speeches of the victor of the Republican presidential nomination and the Democratic presidential nomination for the last 100 years, stripping it of identifiers. You didn't know who gave the speech. You didn't know if it was the victor or the loser. And he asked his graduate students to score these speeches just for one thing. For every optimistic statement, you'd get a point, an optimism point, and every pessimistic statement, you'd lose a point. And it turned out that your optimism score predicted who would be president far better than any polls did. It was like a perfect predictor. Well, almost perfect. Actually, the only exception was FDR. FDR was more pessimistic than the person who lost the election, but that was unusual times, or maybe there's something adaptive about pessimism. I don't know. But it's a fascinating, fascinating take-home message. By the way, he went home, he changed his campaign to make it more positive and less negative, and he won the election. Now, a lot of people hear that, they get upset when they hear that, but I don't know. Now, he wouldn't tell me who it is. Maybe he changed around, maybe he became more positive. I like to think that it had a happy ending, because I'm an optimist. But anyway, so take-home message number three on this happiness connection and being parents to our children on this dimension is optimism can be taught in a variety of ways. We know there's a lot of research. Seligman himself wrote a book called The Optimistic Child. We're using some very compelling research strategies, some research interventions. He was able to take a whole community in suburban Philadelphia and teach children of depressed parents how to be depression-proof, to teach them how to catch depressing thoughts, how to replace them with more accurate thoughts, and actually showed a much lower risk for depression in these kids relative to a control group who didn't have that treatment. These are kids who were at particular risk for depression because their parents were depressed. So we know this stuff could be taught, but I'm more modest here. I have a more modest kind of goal for you. To go back to the study, to go back to the religion study, remember, in connecting to your children on religion more than any other area, to focus on the positive. You find yourself getting into power struggles with them on a specific issue. Choose your battleground. Think for yourself, is this a Yehoreg Valyava? Is this a worthy battleground? Because there's nothing quite as toxic to our children's yadus as making an area of Avodas Hashem a battleground. I'm going to read to you something that is... just interesting. If I could find it, let me just see. Listen to this quote on this thought. It's called "Crashing Through the Woods." It's about this topic, and it goes like this. If we want to support each other's inner lives, we must remember a simple truth. The human soul does not want to be fixed. It wants simply to be seen and heard. If we want to see and hear a person's soul, there's another truth we must remember. The soul is like a wild animal, tough, resilient, and yet shy. When we go crashing through the woods, shouting for it to come out so we can help it, the soul will stay in hiding. But if we're willing to sit quietly and wait for a while, the soul may show itself. Interesting. Interesting way of thinking about how careful we have to be in this area in terms of that component. And let me end with the final area of happiness, and that's, what does the research tell us? What does the secular research tell us about the sources of happiness? So it tells us that it's not the F of funds, it's not money, it's the other three F's: family, friends, and faith. A lot of what we're talking about, components of that. But let me talk a little about the F of faith as the source of happiness. Because part of that dimension of what predicts firm kind, I told you what was number one was the optimism in the study, but number two was time. Number two was parents and mechanchim who were able to spend time with children and connect with them with that ava dimension. So let me just review with you two thoughts. But again, I guess what it's tonight's about is the beautiful Argadal Yahu. And with this, I'll start to bring this to a close because I'd like to have time for questions. Argadal Yahu, Argadal Yashor, I was in Tar V'Das for a number of years. He was Rosh Yeshiva when I was there. And in his Sefer Argadal Yahu, he has this beautiful imagery. And it's an imagery that I want to use to lead into this component. The imagery is the imagery. He talks about how in between Vayigash and Vayichi, there's a famous Rashi that says, Lama Parsha Zustuma, you look at the Torah, there's no space between Vayigash and Vayichi. And the famous Rashi there tells us it's because the spaces in the Torah are metaphors for certain deep psychological meaning. And between Vayigash and Vayichi, there's literally no space. You run on right from Vayigash to Vayichi. Because what's Vayichi? It's the beginning of Shibud Mitzrayim. It's the beginning of being slaves. And we're told, what's the essence of slavery? The essence of slavery is the slave has absolutely no control over his time. The big difference between being a slave and being a free person is control over our time. Then he talks about Rav Shor. He talks about Shira, Parsha Shira. The Parsha that talks about our redemption, the Parsha of freedom, it's set off with a tremendous amount of space. Again, a symbol that song brings us to a free place in our souls and in our hearts. Song brings us to a place that we can breathe. We could breathe. So, let's think a little bit about this component. How do we nurture the religious part of our kids? And I'm going to just tell you over one with Shmulevitz, and then end with the quote that some of you may have heard, but it's really worth reviewing. Rav Shmulevitz goes like this. He talks about why is it that when you compare Shmuel to Moshe, there is a fascinating paradox. Moshe, the greatest of all Nevi'im, has to go to Hashem to receive the Nevuah. He has to go. He has to go there. He has to travel. Shmuel, Hashem comes to him. So Chazal asks, what was the incredible merit that Shmuel, Hashem, went to him? They say the key to the uniqueness of Shmuel was his love of the people. So the question is, where does this love of his people come from? Where does that love? Because he had such love of the Jews that love suffused everything he did, and that's why Hashem came to him in a way that was unique and unsurpassed by even Moshe. So the answer, Rav Shmulevitz says, is in Shmuel's coat. The answer is in Shmuel's coat, the coat he wore. Some of you may know the story of Shmuel's coat, of that me'il. It's an incredible metaphor for what we're talking about. Shmuel's coat, listen to what the Medrash says, beautiful Lashon. Medrash Tanchuma says, what is it about this coat? Bo godal, bo nikfar, bo Allah. What does that mean? He was basically raised in this coat, buried in this coat, and when the witch of Endor calls him up from the grave in order to help Shaul out, he comes back from the other side wearing the coat. What is it about this coat? I'll tell you what it is about this coat. Do any of you remember what the story of this coat was? You have to go back to the story of Shmuel. His mother, Chana, davened in an unparalleled way to have a child. And she finally has her wish come true. And after she weans Shmuel at 2 years of age, she brings him to Eli. She has to leave this little toddler behind. And as she left, what did she leave behind with Shmuel? The small coat that she made herself. And the coat grew with him. It grew with him all through his life and beyond. Here's what Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says. He says it beautifully. He says that every fiber of this special garment was infused with the yearning, aspirations, hopes, and dreams that Chana had for Shmuel. He wore it, and as he wore it, her values were transferred to him and gave him the strength and inspiration to discharge his awesome responsibilities and to ultimately became who he became. He says, what was the secret of Shmuel's love of the people? It was the love of his mother, transferred through the coat. What's that all about? What it's about is that there is no greater gift that a Jewish parent has to give their child than the gift of happiness. And no greater conduit to happiness than a true, deep love of others and love of Hashem. And that's only transmitted through time. In the age of the BlackBerry, in the age of the cell phone, in the age of tremendous pressures on our time, we have to find the time and space in our hearts to weave that coat. And I'll end with one of the most beautiful statements. Some of you may have heard it. It comes from the Hesped that Rev. Yoshe Ber Soloveitchik gave for the Rebbetzin of Talna. And listen to this incredible description of what we're really talking about in terms of this fourth ingredient. He says, I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. She talked Me'inyana Diyoma. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite her tefillos. I used to watch her recite the Sedra every Friday night. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there's a flavor, a scent, and warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life is to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The fathers knew much about the Shabbos. The mothers lived the Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. Beautiful, beautiful. Beautiful. And you think about that imagery, the imagery of the Me'il of Shmuel, the beautiful imagery printed and described so beautifully by Rav Soloveitchik about the Jewish mother and the Jewish father and the different roles they fill. But most importantly, it's all nonverbal. It's not words. It's time. It's the look in our eyes when we're with our children, letting them know that they're the most important thing in our lives. Letting them know they're more important than the BlackBerry, more important than the Trio, more important than the cell phone going off at random moments. Letting them know that in spite of our incredibly busy lives, that we find time to steal for them, because that's the key ingredient through which we weave the beautiful coats that we hope they'll carry with them for the rest of their lives. And those are the ingredients of happiness. So if we want to connect our children to the happiness that comes with connecting them to the line of the Yishrei Lev Simcha, and the line of meaning and the line of their uniqueness, and to the circle of giving and community and the machal of togetherness and happiness through connection to the Kehillah and to Hashem, and ultimately to the optimism and the beautiful lessons that come from true connection to our children, where they see and feel our love for them and our time for them and nourishing their neshamas, those should all give us the schus to raise happy, worthy children who fulfill their dreams and our dreams as well. So thank you, everybody.
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-one.org. That's priority-1.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.